Today's program is brought to you by Michter's Distillery. Visit Michter's.com to find out how their taste is everything, cost be damned attitude is creating some of the finest whiskeys available.
I'm Damon Bolte, host of The Speakeasy. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good morning. You're listening to In the Drink on heritageradionetwork.org. I'm your host, Joe Campanelli. And before we get started today, I do want to make an announcement. This is the last week of our fundraiser drive here at Heritage Radio Network. And in this very last week, if you guys want to donate, we actually have a mysterious philanthropist, probably a crazy eccentric billionaire, but what he's doing is actually going to be matching all of your donations. So if you go to www.heritagenetwork.org and make a donation, it would be as if you were making two donations, but only half will come out of your bank account. So that's great. And thank you so much for your support thus far. It's been a great fundraiser. I'm very excited about our show today. We have Maria Sinski here from Robert Sinski Vineyards in Napa, California. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Joe. Thanks for having me on.
very excited to have you. We recently had Robert, your husband, over at Le Picho, one of our restaurants, to do a winemaker dinner along with Steve Mathiason, and it was a huge success. It was one of our most popular dinners, sold out right away. I wish you could have been there.
I wish I could have been there, too. I heard it was quite a show.
We like to start off this show with some of our favorite or most interesting wines that we drank in the last week. My favorite wine, and I'll give you a moment to think about something that you've had recently that's good. And if you guys hear that in the background, Maria was kind enough to bring quite an assortment of wines to the show. And I'm eager, even though it is 10 a.m., I'm eager to get going, because I know there's some labels I recognize and some that aren't Sinski wines, too, which I'm excited to try. But my favorite wine that I tried this week was the Pietra Cupa Fiano di Avellino from Campania, from Avellino. It's kind of inland, high-altitude volcanic soil. It's a wine that I've known for many years. I actually worked with their distributor here in New York. And I haven't tasted in a while, and I was remembered as to the incredible balance that you get with the great extract of Fiano, the high acidity, and that interesting kind of volcanic salty minerality. Was just an awesome wine. Great for summer. I think great for any time of year, but it just knocked my socks off. But have you had a wine this past week that is particularly memorable?
Yes, actually, the Domaine Vincent Carême Vouvray 2008. Pascaline Lepeltier last night introduced me to this wine, and I'm a huge Chenin Blanc fan. I'm a huge acid head. Any wine that has acid is right up my alley, and this wine was just so beautiful. It had that quince skin, not to get too geeky, but I don't know if you've ever gone and picked a quince from a tree.
I live in New York City.
We don't. Okay.
I know
sure.
That in the heart of California wine country, you have quinces growing and passion fruit and probably like a toucan will fly and land on your shoulder. But no, here in New York, we don't have things like quince tree.
I know, but I don't feel sorry for you, because you guys have a lot here. And I know that figs grow in Brooklyn, or actually in Queens. Mm-hmm. So there's got to be a quince tree somewhere. But anyway, if anybody ever gets a chance to find a quince tree and pick a quince and smell it, that's what this wine was all about, quince. And it had a little bit of residual sugar, but it was so beautiful. The brilliant acidity of it really shined through. And I was so surprised by it. It was like luxurious.
Yeah, and if anyone is an expert in the wines of Loire Valley, it's Pascaline. So I have no doubt that whatever she's going to give you from Loire is going to be pretty amazing.
Yeah, we basically went through all the high acid grapes last night. Great. So, and that for me, it's all about, you know, it's about balance, but it's also having this, you know, being a chef, it's all about having acidity in the wine and a brightness and something that, you know, refreshes your palate and makes you want to eat more.
Yeah. So Maria, as I said, you're You were formerly a chef, or still currently,
I'm still a chef.
Formerly a restaurant chef, and now a winery and home chef. Award-winning chef at that, Food and Wine, Best New Chef, as well as San Francisco Chronicle Awards, and many others. How tell us about your current role and what it means to be culinary director of a winery, because I've been to many wineries all around the world and have never met a culinary director at a winery.
Okay, that was like the official really boring title, but really I'm chief cook and bottle washer. That's my official title. And it's because I basically do everything. So, you know, we raise sheep, we slaughter the sheep, we grow all the vegetables, we pick all the fruit. And it's my job to take all of these foodstuffs that we grow and raise and turn them to something edible in the tasting room, or, you know, for chefs and visiting sommeliers and people that visit the winery. And one thing, you know, wine at the table is the most important thing. I mean, we can talk a lot about this wine and that wine, but really when people, especially when people go to Europe, mm-hmm. if you want to take an old world reference.
As I usually do.
Yeah, people, and me too, because I mean, I'm from New York and I grew up drinking European wines because that's close. But, you know, people go to Europe and they're just so enthralled by sitting down at the table and having these wines, and they come back to the U.S. and they can't capture that experience. And they can get the same wines, but it's that moment. It's where it's the temperature of the air, who they're with, that whole experience. And I really think that, you know, wine at the table, that's where wine belongs. That to me is the end all be all for that. That's what I reach for, is being at the table and having a glass of wine and maybe getting like a pairing, because people are so stuck on pairings. And I'm thinking, you know what? If you don't like the wine with the food, open another bottle or don't eat it with the food. But it's just that, just, you know, and in Europe, you know, wine grows up with food. I mean, the grapes that are grown in the dirt raises certain crops, and it's just kind of this natural, you know, coming together of food and wine. And in the U.S., we're a melting pot, not just of you know, cuisine, of people from around the world that have brought everything, but wine is a melting pot here too.
I agree. You know, I was going to ask you a selection of pairings at the end of the show, but
can't we do something? Can't we have another
one? No, but you're right. I love that that European aspect of you have the wine on the table and it is as important as anything else and not much more so, right? So you can't have a full table without the wine, nor is it necessarily the be all and end all, the star.
There's no pressure. Pressure, you know? And that's the thing, people feel, I think that in the US we're so pressured for everything we do, like to be good at this and be good at that, and this has to go with this, and this, your shoes have to match your outfit, and your handbag has to match your shoes. And it's like we put so much pressure on ourselves, and wine's not about pressure. It's about, you know, just relaxation. It's about, you know, I mean, it's lifestyle.
Yeah. You know? It's funny. People don't look at other fancy food products in that same way that they do wine. They don't say, you know, I really like olive oil, but I'm no olive oil expert. I really like cheese, but I'm no cheese expert. And you always hear that with wine. People feel a pressure that they need to know so much about it in order to enjoy it. And I enjoy the knowing about it and learning about it, but I don't think that is a prerequisite to enjoy wine.
Well, I think there's only so much room in the room for geeks, because my husband basically, I started studying for my master's of wine, and basically said, Rob, my husband, told me that I've emasculated him, because now when we walk into a restaurant, he just hands me the list. He's like, you know, just take it. Just take the list, look at it, and you know, I can geek out more than anybody. Sometimes he tells me, or he says, you're going to that far off place, and he knows, because I pick up a glass of wine, I smell it, and my eyes glaze over, and I'm starting to think about, oh, what grape is this? Blah blah blah. Total geekdom, but sometimes that's a big turn off to people that you know, they're not geeks. They're like, hey, you know, I like this wine, I don't like this wine, and I'm like, perfect. That's the way it should be. You like it or you don't like it.
That's it. Yeah, I definitely don't do the whole swirling, the slurping of the wine at the dinner table with my girlfriend's parents. You know, it's not.
They'll think something's wrong with you.
Yeah, I agree with that. So are you still working on the MW? You're working.
I took a break. actually, it was a forced break. I took the exam 3 times and didn't pass enough of it to get a half pass. So sadly, I bowed out for a couple of years.
Yes.
But a well-needed break, because it is so much pressure. And with 2 kids and a business to run and everything thrown at me, it's actually, I'm just having such a good time not studying all the time.
Yeah, I did the first year of the program, and they recommended that I move on to the second year. And then I took a 6-year break and no plans to resume. It is a lot of work.
But the journey is so much fun, and learning about going and tasting with people. And I mean, the blind wine game, the blind tasting game is awesome. I love doing that. And my husband does it to me all the time. He embarrasses me. He's always like, okay, now Maria's going to guess this wine. It's a parlor game. But I had a really good time in the program. I met so many great people, and there's so many amazing MWs. And MWs, they're not MSs, so they're not in the service part. So it's a little bit different. It's a little bit more, it's a little bit more inward journey than an outward journey. But it was really, really fun, and I'll go back, and I'm going to go back and pass that thing.
Yes, we're rooting for you.
I'll be the only chef. I'll be the only chef that's ever been dumb enough to go after that.
Speaking about your chef and your cooking, how has working and living at the winery affected the way that you cook?
Actually, we should reverse that question. How has my cooking, because at first,
changed the winery?
Well, yeah, the thing is, my cooking's always been very simple. It's pretty much taking whatever is in the ground or whatever is around you seasonally and putting it together and making a meal. And, when I married my husband, it's really funny because I said, honey, you married me because you wanted to have a private chef. And he turns to me, he goes, Maria, it would have been a hell of a lot cheaper if I just hired a chef. So that's his big comeback every time I say that. But before I came on board, they'd always been making, there was a chef before me at the winery. And he had started the whole cooking program because our wines are really meant for food. And we hear blah, 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 everybody says that. But we've tried to, through our farming methods, which are biodynamic and organic, really working to, now I'm going to get geeky, to balance in the vines. I mean, plants want to balance. Everybody wants balance. Human beings want balance in their body and their life. Vines want balance in the vineyard. It's all about balancing fruit with the canopy, vice versa. So we've tried to achieve balance in our wines through farming. And as a result, we have wines that are more restrained, brighter acidity, naturally, lower alcohol. And these are wines that
you're not dumping bags of tartaric acid in there?
No. As a matter of fact, we do have some, we have this white bucket of tartaric acid, and it's kind of grungy. And basically, I use it for cooking for cream of tartar. I take it to cook with because Jeff rarely, rarely uses it. So it's been sitting there and sitting there and sitting here. And I watch this white bucket get grungier and grungier, but inside it's still clean. But so I take that and I actually cook with it. So that's acid comes in bags. Yes, it does. But, you don't want to dump it in. And of course, there are some vintages where you want to help a little bit. But, the thing is, everybody looks at adding acid as this big, big, bad thing. But the alternative is picking underripe. Now, I think that you shouldn't pick grapes overripe. I think you should pick them when they're ready. And yes, you can maybe like fudge that a little and pick it a little earlier. But to pick underripe to preserve the acidity, you also lose a lot of the aromatics, all the phenolics that are in the ripe skin. So it's about balance.
Hi, I'm Jesse Kiefer, host of The Morning After. This summer, Heritage Radio Network is turning cinco. That's 5 for you non-Spanish speakers. Since our launch in 2009, we've continued to bring you food, culture, and content like nobody else. And we need your help. HeritageRadioNetwork.org is a passionate, grassroots, action-oriented nonprofit organization. That means we depend on the support from listeners like you to keep us alive. If you love what you hear on Heritage Radio Network, visit our website and become a member today. Thanks for listening, and thanks so much for your support.
Michter's Distillery is a proud sponsor of In the Drink and HeritageRadioNetwork.org. At Michter's, our passion is making the finest whiskeys possible. When you only make small batch and single barrel whiskeys like Michter's does, your whiskey has to be perfect. No detail is too small. From careful attention to the wood used in the construction of our barrels, to lower barrel entry proof before heat-cycled aging in advance of exacting chill filtration. and no whiskey gets bottled until Michter's master distiller says it's just right. Michter's Cost Be Damned Taste Is Everything attitude is apparent in every sip of its smooth, rich whiskeys. Is it worth it? A lot of spirits lovers seem to think so. Food & Wine magazine called Michter's the best American whiskey. Bon Appetit said, it's amazing. And the Wall Street Journal had one special word for Michter's, phenomenal. For more information, visit Michter's.com or simply visit your favorite bartender or retailer and ask for Michter's.
Now, going back to the farming, the grapes are all farmed organically and biodynamically. Is the how has that approach to farming affected the food at the winery?
How has it affected the food? Well, you know, well, the good thing is that all the food now that we serve is organic and biodynamic because,
that's
you know, the vegetables and everything, it's not just about the grapes, it's about everything we grow. And I think that, does it have more nutrition? Does it have more flavor? Well, I think anything that you grow and pull from the ground and it's so fresh and it doesn't have time to lose its vitamins and all the nutrition in it, I think that it's been really positive that we have these animals and vegetables and fruits that are really good tasting. And but just keep it simple. If you have a great beet, mm-hmm. don't screw it up. You know, if you have wonderful lamb, don't screw it up. Don't try and hide the flavors. Keep things simple. You know, sometimes, I mean, salt is my biggest seasoning and herbs that I pick from around the winery. So I think it's very synergistic. I think that for me, it's about being simple, and simple when in cooking is much harder than adding a lot of things. And I find particularly with young cooks is they always want to add something for color and they needs more of this and needs more of that. And when you start throwing everything together, it starts masking the beauty of your ingredients. So I think that just cooking at the winery and the journey over the years, I've even pulled back even more and let the ingredients speak for themselves.
More simple, more restrained.
Yeah.
You know, a criticism of biodynamic winemaking is that, or at least grape growing, is that it's really something that can only be done on a very small scale. Now, Sinski has grown to about 200 acres, which is not massive and industrial, but it's also not a tiny winery. It's a medium size, medium to big size, you know, winery. How would you respond to this criticism? I mean, you guys are clearly doing it successfully.
I think that's everybody's excuse for not doing it. It takes a lot of effort. It's a lot of time. It's a lot of money. But biodynamics is about the health of the soil. And basically, if you don't have healthy soil, nothing grows well. I mean, you can grow it, you can fertilize it, you can add everything that vine needs artificially, or you can build up the organic matter in the soil, build up the microbial activity so that the vines can access nutrients and be healthier, so there's less spray, so the fruit is more balanced. Because, you know, the grapes, it's not just a grape. That grape has so many chemicals and, well, natural compounds, chemicals. I mean, what is a chemical? Oh, God, I'm going down the rabbit hole. But
let's go with natural compounds.
Compounds.
Even if chemicals accurate, you know, I think it has it creates a visceral
acid,
feeling in people.
You know,
so yeah, let's go natural compounds.
Potassium. There's all these different minerals and acids in grapes that they need this balanced mm-hmm. soil. They need this healthy soil. So if you do it on 10 acres or on 200 acres, it's all about making the soil happy and nutritious for the vines. And so you can do it on any scale you want. It just depends on how much effort you want to put into it and how much money you want to put into it. And for us, it's not about the money. Yes, we want to make money because everybody wants to make money, right? But we don't have to make a pile of money. We want to make a wine that we're really proud of, that goes really well with what we do, what we eat. We want people to enjoy it, and we want to have a really good product that's not manipulated. And so we're not going to grow any bigger. My husband and I have both agreed that we're done. Like, this is our capacity, and that's it. So, and not we've pulled out a lot of acres, actually, mm-hmm. right now, because we're doing a lot of Masal selection. So we're doing a lot of, we're selecting our biomaterial, which Rob has always done. He actually saved when the big Phylloxera event came with AXR, and everyone was ripping out
Was he originally planted on AXR?
Yes, some of our vineyards, and people were planting.
So for you guys who don't know,
that's geeky.
That's pretty geeky. UC Davis suggested that everyone plant on the supposedly phlox-resistant rootstock, AXR 16, is it?
Was it? I called the cross trainer.
Unfortunately, UC Davis was incorrect about the level of phylloxera resistance that this rootstock had. So there was a massive planting on it, and then 10 years later, maybe a massive replanting when everyone realized that their vines were being destroyed by phylloxera.
Yeah, and people were ripping up these vines, and a lot of them had these heirloom selections. People call them heirloom now. And Rob realized that, and so he saved a lot of the cuttings. So we've always had a lot of cuttings from older selections. So, and we're starting to do a lot of our own selections now, so and cleaning them up. So
yeah, anytime it's a big tragedy of phylloxera. Not only is money and vintages and wine lost, but variety is lost. I just think about in the 19th century when it first hit Europe, how many more grapes were there that never got replanted because maybe they were too difficult to grow, and they said, well, let's plant with something that's more marketable, or it was just so small that there was no genetic material left.
Right.
So the variety decreases significantly anytime you have a big vineyard disease event like that. So it's great. I think that's great work that is able to save some of the heirloom clones.
Yeah, no, I think it's really important. And these are actually vines that have adapted. This material has adapted to the California climate. Mm. And so what's been happening in Europe for centuries, what's happening in California, these plants were adapting to their climate. So to just rip them out and start looking at a catalog and saying, I'm going to plant a Dijon clone. Like, I hear Dijon, I hear Pommard, and we do have small amounts of that because there is a place in the blend. And we're talking about Pinot Noir now. But to have everything planted to that is, like, boring.
Yes. Okay, so we're talking about wine. No guest has ever brought me so much wine, so I'm so excited. What have you brought to share with us?
Well, I brought our Pinot Blanc, our Abraxas.
Yes.
And a Clos du Capucin from Domaine Weinbach Pinot Blanc.
Okay.
Which I really love. I brought our 2011 Pinot Noir, Los Carneros, and I brought a Pommard from Jean-Michel Gonneau. And because I feel like you can never taste wine in a vacuum.
Yes.
It's really important to, particularly when you're making your own wine, is to always taste what's going on in the rest of the world, just for reference and just to see. I mean, it's not about competition. It's about just, it's about exploring. It's about educating yourself. And these wines, we have them in the ice bucket here. And
yeah, should we taste the two Pinot Blancs?
Yeah, I think we should. I think they're. Are you going to drink out of the bottle?
If you didn't say anything, they wouldn't have been able to see it.
I know. Get the straw.
Jack, do we have crazy straws back there?
Oh, no. We actually have a drawer of crazy straws at home. I can't throw them out. I'm afraid I won't be able to replace them.
Okay, so we have here the Robertsonsky Vineyards Pinot Blanc 2012 vintage from Carneros.
Yes, and this comes from our Carneros. We basically have most of our grapes are planted in the Napa side of the Carneros. We do have some planted in our one Sonoma Carneros vineyard, which is called Cintia. And I love this Pinot Blanc. This Pinot Blanc was actually... It was planted to blend into our Chardonnay that we used to make. And we had the Chardonnay vineyard was on AXR. And that kind of was the impetus to get going on the biodynamics and organics because they said this vineyard is not going to last. You need to rip it out. And that's when my husband went into the vineyard and realized like the soil was dead and something had to change. And so 10 years later, we finally ripped out the Chardonnay vineyard. And we had planted this to blend into that Chardonnay. And... all of a sudden, when we replanted it, we didn't like what we replanted. It was still a great Chardonnay, but we're like, we're done with that. Done with Chardonnay. You know, we're not going to do that anymore. So the Pinot Blanc was left.
Wow. So that, you just think about that, that how much time and I'm sure money as well, it takes to say, let's try Chardonnay. I don't like the Chardonnay. This is like a many-year project going on. It's not an overnight thing where you're like, let's try to put, veal shank on the menu tonight. That didn't sell well. The guests didn't really like it, so we'll take it off tomorrow night.
And that's a big thing between making wine. And, you know, and when people, you know, wines for me, and especially the wines we make, it's really personal. So I understand that everybody has different palates, but if someone says something about our wine, I have to like kind of swallow and think, like, don't rip their head off. No, no, actually, what I think
I'm keeping my comments to myself.
No, what I think is that, okay, if you don't like it, that's fine because you probably like a different style and we all of our palates are so different. What you like or what you're tasting might be completely opposite of what I think. And I think that's part of the problem when you're talking about wine to a novice. You're saying like quince and apple skin and pips and everything. And they're going, what the heck? I don't taste that. I taste something fruity.
You know, I personally actually tried to keep particular tasting notes to speaking when I'm speaking with other professionals. I don't think it's personally a useful way to convey wines to guests. I'd rather tell the story about what you guys are doing and then talk more about the structure and why it might be good with something that they're eating.
I think that's great. And a lot of times when I'm out peddling our wines, I sometimes don't even talk. I forget to talk about the wine.
Yes.
Because I'm telling the story and I'm like, does it really matter? Do you like it or not? Do you like it?
Speaking of the wine, so we have the Pinot Blanc, and my first impression is that it's more aromatic than I was expecting for the Pinot Blanc grape, which is not really known for its aromatics. Really nice. Not that it is like Riesling Gewürztraminer or aromatic, but a little bit more complex, more floral notes than I was expecting.
But that's New World. I mean, that's New World. And you know, New World always gets kind of like the shaft a little bit. But again, when you're talking about expression of place, when you think about New World wines and when you talk to Old World producers, they're talking about New World wines and how their wines compare to the New World. And they're not poo-pooing New World wines like New World producers poo-poo New World wines.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of this like, be careful what you wish for.
I can't tell you how many winemakers, sons and daughters who are going to enology school in Europe, then do their apprenticeship in, I'm sure you see them in California all the time. And these are wineries that, you know, that we all greatly respect and we love the wines. They're sending their kids to the New World to learn a different way of doing things.
A different way. And also, I hate to say it, but a cleaner way. I mean, I love natural wines. I love opening the bottle. I mean, I'm opening my whole new bag of worms are here. But I love natural wines and I love the story of the natural wines. But sometimes I just want a glass. Sometimes a whole bottle is a bit too much for me, but they're super interesting and they have a great story and the way they're made. I think natural wines also, because you're a big natural wine person.
Wow,
we could totally, we're going to arm wrestle on this one. But you know, a lot of these natural wines taste really good right where they're made.
Yes.
Do you know how you go there? And that's like one of those experiences. You go there and you're like, this wine is mind-blowing. But then you put it into a case and you ship it all the way over here. And sometimes it doesn't taste the same. Do you think that? I'm questioning you now.
Well, I don't. So there is a common perception amongst our guests. And I think it's very common with many people who aren't in the industry that when you drink wine in the country that it's from, that it is somehow a different product, even if it's the same bottle. They say, oh, but they add many more sulfites for the export.
I've heard that too.
And this happens, it still happens all the time. So I know we're talking about natural wine that's separate, but I definitely want to say, if a winemaker is bottling wine, they don't put a certain portion aside for the export market.
No, they don't. It's the same wine.
So, but yes, natural wines are more delicate. Require much better handling, better storage. It could be not to the natural winemaker's fault that at some point along the shipping, it was exposed to some heat. And if it was unfiltered and unsulfured, it's going to not be so yummy.
But people that know natural wines accept that. I mean, that's the one thing.
Well, I don't accept a faulty wine.
Well, I don't think that they're necessarily faulty. We are really digging ourselves into this, and I don't think that we should go there right now. But anyway, the whole thing about my point was, before we went down that rabbit hole, was that, you know, New World wine shouldn't be poo-pooed for being aromatic or being clean. Because, I mean, look at Sauvignon Blanc in Bordeaux. it's taken off. I don't know whether to its detriment or not, but they found ways to make it in a cleaner style, in a fresher style, and it's done great things for Entre Deux Mer.
Yes.
And a lot of those, because you're using stainless steel now. Is that good or bad? I don't know. I kind of want to say to the Bordelais, keep making the wine you used to make that took 20 years, 30 years to come around. But how do you tell people they can't have the newest TV? You know what I mean? It's like, oh no, you can't start selecting berry by berry so that your wine is more like California wine. You can't do this. You can't. Because I am a traditionalist. I love that old style. I love funky Burgundies. Do you remember when Burgundies used to be like, well, it was kind of a crapshoot when you open the bottle? Is it going to be
sake or mushroomy?
Is it going to be pooey or is it going to be fermenting or what is it going to And now they look at Burgundy. Everybody's cleaned up their acts. Better cellar practices. Yes. They've traveled. And so the wines are cleaner. Is that necessarily worse? I don't know. Should we say, no, go back to your stinky ways? Sorry, all you. I don't mean that all Burgundy producers are stinky. But meaning should you go back to when you didn't know about keeping things sanitary? Like, because wine has always been about sanitation and all these sulfur, all these ways to sanitize and make things cleaner and better. We are now poo-pooing and saying, no, we actually want to go back. But back is more interesting, I think. And I think before, when you opened a bottle of wine, it was kind of like, is it going to be good?
Yes.
You know, or is it going to be perfect every time? Because if it's perfect every time, that's kind of boring.
That's boring as well.
But then people like reliability. People like to have, if they're spending money on a bottle of wine.
Especially an expensive bottle of wine.
So it's like this whole, you can go around in circles over and over again. Like, do we want it that way? Do we want it the new way? What do we want? What do we really, we just want a
good glass of
wine. We want a nice glass of wine.
That's all we want.
Exactly.
The other thing that surprised me about this wine was, and I know you've said that the A word a few times already, but it does have really good acidity, not just for a Napa Valley wine, but for the Pinot Blanc grape, which is really not known for that.
Actually, good Pinot Blanc has a pretty good amount of acid in it.
Well,
Moderate plus.
Oh,
is it high? I know that's a geeky thing we say, but moderate. You knew what I was talking about.
It's not sexy at all to say moderate plus.
I know. It has good acidity, and it has a propensity to overripen quickly.
Yes.
And lose its acidity. So, but I really like this wine because it's just fresh and clean, and it does have aromatics. And we're going to taste the Weinbach now. Does that mean I have to drink this whole glass?
Yeah. Or you have the other glasses, too.
No.
All right. I'll drink this glass.
Here.
All right.
I almost slurped. I almost did. That would have been nasty.
I did it off mic.
You did it off mic?
Yeah.
I almost did it on
so
mic.
I have to give a shout out to one of our producers, Jory Morales, who was recently at your winery. He's waving, saying hi, and saying that we only have a couple minutes left, unfortunately.
Oh, bummer.
But he came in May, had a spectacular time. And I know he's a big fan of the Sinsky Rosé, which I totally agree with him. It's one of my favorite domestic rosés. It's a spectacular wine.
Well, the Van Griet, Rob started making that in 1991, and he could not sell it. No one wanted dry pink wine. And he just kept on making it and making it and making it. I mean, you know, snotty people that wanted something really fancy would not allow it to be put into their glass because, heaven forbid, they had something pink in their glass. But he kept doing it and doing it, and now the whole world is pink, which is awesome.
I can't believe I'm saying this. So the Weinbach tastes so similar to yours, actually, but with less acid. It's really nice as well.
But it's aromatic, though.
Mm-hmm. It is aromatic. The aromatics are very similar. Completely different terroir.
It is completely different terroir. And the thing about, I love Domaine Weinbach wines. I was cooking in Alsace, and every free hour I was at a winery tasting wines, and I fell in love with Alsatian wines. And one reason we got on the Abraxas Divine Terroir, it's Alsatian varietals, because my crazy husband thought, okay, you know, we'll plant these in a cool spot and see if it works. And they did. And so I love Alsace.
Yes.
I think the food is amazing. You can't rent a villa there and have a sunny holiday, but you know, it's pretty beautiful.
I'm a big fan of the Abraxas. It's been on our list at Le Picho since we first opened. It's one of my favorite wines.
I didn't pay him to say that.
No, it's the truth. You can go to our website right now. You'll see it on the list. And this is delicious. Thank you so much for bringing this.
You're welcome.
I really appreciate it. Okay, so let's taste Abraxas really quick because then we need to.
I don't want to go. This has been so much fun.
You had such an interesting life. Living in Alsace. I've
traveled around the world. I mean, I'm a traveler. My husband says, don't anybody talk about a trip because I will pack my suitcase and go.
Jeez.
Here's a glass for you.
So one of the other things I like about it, and this is such a mundane, geeky question, but you have these really cool glass stoppers on the top. I know they're super pricey, but you never have to worry about corkage.
No. Corky-ness. You actually have to worry about corkage when you bring a bottle of wine into a restaurant, but not a quirky stinky wine. Yeah, that prevents that. But also, you know, these wines are meant to be drunk in a couple of years of release. And we actually were introduced to this closure by Domaine Weinbach. Someone handed Rob the bottle and said, "Hey, you know, I think you'd be, you know, interested in this closure." And he goes, "If it's good enough for Weinbach, it's good enough for us." Because those ladies are, you know, they're right on top of what they're doing.
Yeah. And if you're not like me and carry a corkscrew around wherever you go, I can't tell you how many times I've had them confiscated at the airport from me.
Your favorite corkscrew.
Too many times. It's really frustrating. It's also nice. You bring it on a picnic and you can just pop it open.
It's great.
It's easy.
They are great. And the thing is, my husband went to Parsons School of Design here in New York, and he's very much into aesthetics in packaging. Mm. And so we don't do screw caps because aluminum smelting is so toxic. It's one of the most toxic processes. So that's kind of our environmental California-ness coming out. But this is you can recycle these if you can take them to a recycling center that mm-hmm. does small glass pieces. And we reuse them all the time to reseal any bottle. It might not be an exact fit, but it's a great closure for this wine. It keeps it fresh. It keeps it constant. And again, you can reuse the closure. So that helps.
Well, cheers. I'm so happy to be drinking Abraxas with you in the morning in Bushwick. This is like a dream come true for me. Maria, it has been such a pleasure to have you on the show. I have never personally visited Sinski, but for all my accounts of Jory and all of the guests I've sent there, everyone says it's just an absolutely incredible visit, and we are proud to have your wines at La Picho.
Well, thank you. Thank you for your support.
And thank you so much for your support. Thank you so much for listening. This has been In the Drink on heritageradionetwork.org.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.